Welcome to the Tactical Tennis Podcast. My name's Glenn Hill.
I'm Jacob Meyer.
And this marks the first ever podcast for Tactical Tennis. And we're here to talk about tennis tactics, technique, the Pro Tour, and strategy. So we're going to kick off the first ever episode talking about Canadian Milos Raonic, who rocketed to number 3 in the rankings to finish 2016. And obviously, he's just in the process of that, lost his coach Carlos Moya to Rafael Nadal.
Yeah, how much do you think it's fair to really call him his coach?
Well, that's a good question, you know. I mean, Raonic is kind of an interesting character in that, you know, I mean, he's 25 now. Obviously, he finishes the year ranked number 3, which is a phenomenal achievement. You know, but he's got a coach who had a astoundingly different play style to him. You know, I mean, Moya, obviously, much more of a clay court specialist, although quite a accomplished hard court player as well, when we think about it. But, you know, to go from a Carlos Moya, who had that just phenomenally massive forehand.
So good.
You know, I still have memories of him on the clay, literally standing outside the doubles alley, hitting inside-out forehands. You know, but, you know, to go from...
How fast could that guy run backwards?
Pretty stinking fast, you know. But point being, you know, I mean, he has obviously a very, very different game than the Canadian, whose game is essentially built around one of the most dominant serves that we've ever seen from somebody under the height of 6'9" in the sport of tennis.
Yeah, he might even catch those 6'9"ers.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Yeah, absolutely. But so, you know, the flip side of that, though, is when we look at why Raonic finished third this year, despite, you know, I mean, obviously he had some pretty good Grand Slam results making finals at Wimbledon, but didn't win any slams. And, you know, looking at that final, can we really say that he was genuinely a threat to win any slams? That might be a little bit of a stretch. I'm kind of reminded a little bit of back in the day when Malavi Washington made the Wimbledon final. You know, and it was more just like the absence. It kind of, he filled a little vacuum, a temporary vacuum. But, you know, Washington was never really going to take that title home. Yeah, so, you know, obviously I would say that Moya's had an impact. I think it would be fair to say that. What, I mean, do you think that would be fair to say?
You know, I don't know. I remember watching Moya practice with him in Australia at the beginning of the year, and I mean, Milos has some less than average practice habits in the first place. Like, he does a lot of what a lot of players would call weird stuff, but I think really he's just sort of ahead of the curve. Like, he works with technology and does high tech stuff, and, you know, he'll sort of try everything. Like, he seems eager in a good way.
Right, but you described it as less than average. I mean, that doesn't exactly...
Well, because it was just... It's like his practices just don't look like what the other guys do.
Right, but I mean, when you say less than average, you make it sound like you feel like his practices are maybe not as good as what the rest of the pros are doing.
I don't mean to imply that at all. I just mean less than average because I didn't want to say they were like really weird and we all kind of just stare at them and trying to figure out what's going on.
Right. Okay.
You know, and you certainly, I mean, you're not going to, well, you can't use his results to argue against whatever he's doing in practice.
Sure, sure. I mean, you and I both have had this long-standing belief that most pros are not very productive with their practice court time. So, you know, him doing things differently, maybe obviously a good thing. I mean, third in the rankings.
He's always working on something, and that part is clearly good. He seems to identify skills. I take some issues sometimes with, I think, how he goes about developing those skills, but I mean, heck, he's light years ahead of a lot of guys that don't even actually have targeted practices.
Sure.
But it was interesting because Moya just seemed to be sort of almost like learning the ropes, like trying to figure out, okay, like, what is this guy doing? You know, I mean, I would say 99.9%, just because I don't want to say 100%, there's no way that Milos's practice when Moya showed up looked anything like what Moya's practice did when Moya was a player.
Well, sure. But then again, I would also say that the practices that I run when I'm running a practice with a player look very, very different from the practices or the way that I practice when I was playing. I mean, that's the goal, isn't it? To evolve.
Right. So, yeah, I think that should be the goal, but that's not what everybody's goal is. That's certainly not, or at least where, you know, once guys make it onto the tour, where their motivation is, they've got bigger concerns, like, you know, trying not to lose today.
Right. Well, but okay, but let's cut to the chase here, because I mean, like, we obviously have seen a huge improvement in Raonic's consistency. I mean, he did finish the year ranked third, and I mean, his serve was phenomenal in 2015, obviously, and it was equally phenomenal in 2016. But when we look at what's changed, it's mostly been an improvement in his return game. You know, in 2015, you know, he was winning 23.7% of first serves. And then in 2016, he gained almost 5% on that, 28. On second serve returns, he went from 44% up to 49%. That took him from 78th on the ATP Tour in second serve points won to up to 46, which is, I mean, a pretty sizable leap. And then jumped 20 spots in the percent of games broken on return. So, I mean, the return games where we've seen the biggest impact, and I would say that we could probably maybe
infer...
Do
you attribute that to Moya?
Well, I think Moya could get at least some of the credit, right? I mean, can we not give him some of the credit?
I mean, I can. I mean, we could give him all the credit if we want to. I just don't know. I really don't know. I mean, to me, I think, you know, having Moya in your corner certainly isn't going to hurt your work ethic, and it's certainly not going to hurt your forehand.
Right.
I mean, or at least I would like to think so.
Right, sure.
You know, I don't think of Moya as being a particularly good returner. I mean, the forehand return was very good. You know, the backhand was, I mean, Moya's backhand makes Milos's backhand look like $1 million.
Right.
You know, and, you know, Milos is still really young. I just don't know how much you would attribute the improvement on the return game to work that Moya really did versus just another year on the tour and continuing to develop and do all the stuff that Milos has done. Because, I mean, he wasn't a good returner as a junior. He wasn't. I mean, he's always had this very particular game style.
Right.
Well, I say always. I mean, probably since he was at least 15, 16 years old, where he's just bombing serves and, you know, he's very good on short balls and he's probably less than 50-50 if he ends up back behind the baseline, even though he can club the ball, you know, really well.
Sure.
And, you know, to me, the biggest, like, the biggest thing that I can say for sure is, you know, Moya, you're a celebrity coach, and you walked into a camp with a guy that has a lot of talent, is what people say, but really, I mean, he's just got weapons. And he does things differently than everybody else, and you got to give Moya a lot of credit for just not screwing it up.
Fair, fair.
I mean, I think there were a lot of guys, like, I mean, Johnny Mack came in and out during the year, and obviously, he didn't screw things up. Milos did well at Wimbledon, but he also didn't last.
Right.
You know, and it doesn't seem like Milos wanted to get rid of Moya. It you know, it seems like something else happened down there. But
right. Well, I mean, think we can
do something right.
Figure out at least a part of what happened there. Well, so okay, so Moya leaves the team now and moves over to Nadal. So what does 2016 hold for Raonic then? I mean, can this guy win a slam in 2017?
Well, he's brought on a new celebrity coach, hasn't he?
Did he? I missed that one.
Well, maybe we'll save that one for another day.
Okay.
But in 2016, in 2017,
yeah.
It's 2016, it's, you know, the change of the year is always tough for me. But I think he's going to basically do more of the same. I mean, he's obviously got, he's got a cannon. And he's got real potential. People that are, I think, really big fans of his want to say that he's got number one potential. And, you know, he's number three. He's still relatively young. It'd be hard to argue that he doesn't have number one potential.
Right. I mean, 25 is the new 21 in today's game, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. I still haven't made up my mind about it because, you know, we've been missing Mr. Federer for the second half of the year.
Sure.
Rafa hasn't been himself.
May never be again, but yeah.
It may never be again, and that's really, I mean, that's, I think, a big part of the answer to the question for what are we going to see from Milos this year I think we're going to see his level be pretty close to what it was in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
The question is going to be how many guys are out there that are going to be able to play at a higher level than that when it comes time to the, you know, to the big shows.
Okay. So okay, let's cut this short a little bit then. So does Raonic win a slam in 2017? Yes or no?
I say no.
Okay. Does he win a slam before he retires?
Surely.
Surely. Like, okay, so how many then? Were you talking one, two, and where is he going to break through first?
I don't know how many. I wouldn't be surprised at all if his career looked a lot like Richard Krajicek.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of comparison there. I mean, Krajicek also obviously massive serve. Much better volleys and big forehand. I think maybe just kind of a little bit of a cleaner all around game. I mean, I always remember Krajicek's game as just being you know, really quite nice. Obviously really suffered from big man movement problems, but okay.
Which
so
he moves really well, but
yeah,
I
he does.
That, I
for
think
his size.
That Raonic has the best chance to scoop up a Wimby if he can get the right draw in the final.
Right.
He can beat anybody in a quarter. I
right.
Mean, anybody.
Sure.
The question is, you know, I mean, I don't see him beating Andy Murray in a final.
Okay, so you think he steals one or two slams then in his career, most likely at Wimbledon?
I think he slides in for Wimby, and then I would venture to say that he's either gonna have just that one, or that he's gonna get three.
Okay.
I don't see him winning a second slam, especially if it's not a Wimbledon.
Right.
And then be unable to win another one.
Fair enough. Do you think that he ever reaches number one?
My gut tells me no.
Yeah. No, I'd agree. I mean, the thing with me is he reminds me a lot of Cilic in that, I mean, he's got weapons, obviously, but, you know, I just, the defense is missing. You know, when we look at where the game has evolved to now, I think that you just cannot go out and compete at the Masters and go deep in the Masters consistently and win slams year in, year out, and not be able to defend well and be, you know, at least top 20 or top 30 in most of the return statistics.
Yeah.
You know,
there were some guys that got to number one. I mean, there haven't been that many number one guys in the books ever. Just, I mean, you know, if you don't look at those stats, it's not obvious. I mean, it's what,
right.
It's like 50 guys or something. How many?
Maybe not even that many. Yeah, sure.
Can't remember off the top of my head, but I mean, Andy Murray, I mean, at most, it's like 55 people have ever been number one. So it's
right.
Not that many people. There have been some guys that don't have what I would call like huge weapons. And I'm talking like that don't have Milos's serve or, you know,
Federer's forehand.
Or Federer's forehand was, you know, a thing of beauty. I'm thinking like, you know, the Marcelo Rios.
Right, who was number one for a couple of weeks, right?
He had a huge game, but he was not a huge guy. But who's the worst mover? Like, the worst, like, guy who could physically get around a court?
Well, I never got to number one? That's Agassi, probably.
That's exactly right.
Love and the death, those little bow legs did not go all that fast, you know?
He just couldn't. You couldn't move backwards.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, his side to side wasn't all that crash hot either, let's be honest. So, yeah, no, I agree. And without the movement.
Circles around me,
yeah, without the movement, I mean, you can't defend, you can't be number one. Not in today's game. I mean, I think the days of being able to be a Boris Becker and just go out there and smack serves and, you know, crash the net and make it work are gone. You know, and I think that era has passed us by. But speaking of defense, let's move on and talk about.
Who's the best mover that ever got to number one?
Oh God, let's save that discussion because we'll be here all day. But I think one of the best movers that ever got to number one is next up, and we're actually going to follow Moya here and go from Raonic to Nadal. And obviously Nadal has now named Moya as his coach. What was your gut reaction when you heard the news?
The first thing that I thought was, well, why didn't he do that last year? And then I felt almost bad for Milos, like he was like a test case.
Right,
because those two guys go way back.
Well, that's also, you know,
back to when Rafa was a kid.
Sure, and you have to also wonder too, though, is whether or not, you know, the Nadal camp didn't necessarily see the need. I mean, you know, one off year. I mean, obviously 2015 wasn't real great for Rafa, but you know, maybe they just felt like they were going to get things back on track. kind of return to their roots. And then when that didn't pan out for 2016, it was like, okay, it's time to make a change, you know?
You know, I don't know if I buy that. I think Uncle Tony is pretty open-minded. They brought in somebody else to help him with a serve,
but
in order to
didn't keep him around and never really gave him much credit either.
Yes, that's true, and he's slid back and he's lost those changes. And it's interesting because Tony has said, and I mean, I really shouldn't be bringing this up, I guess, without knowing where it came from, but I'm pretty sure that at some point I read in an interview that Uncle Tony has said that basically they need help with certain things, but that
right.
it's just a complicated situation. I mean,
sure.
you know, it's like you don't I look at like basketball and like Phil Jackson and Kobe Bryant and Shaq, like it's easy to say, well, anybody can win with those guys, anybody can coach those guys, but the truth is that's not accurate. I mean, we were just talking about how McEnroe lasted like 4 weeks with Raonic and then he was, you know, gone.
Right. Well, was that maybe always the plan? But I suppose that's draws us right back into Raonic again. Well, okay, so do you think that Moya adds something to Nadal's team and has an impact for his 2017 season?
I think it's a good sign. I think bringing him on says something and tells us something about where Rafa is in his head, and it shows a certain level of commitment to doing certain things.
Right.
And that it's he has an actual relationship with Carlos Moya.
I mean, I think it wouldn't even almost call it a relationship. I think it goes beyond that. It's more familial than anything. You know, they're almost like brothers or uncle cousin. I'm not quite sure what that would look like.
Close.
But they're very, very close, obviously.
He will have a real sense of responsibility. He does have a real sense of responsibility to him.
I think he always has, yeah.
I mean, Moya had a good gig with Milos. I don't think this is, oh, Raonic dumped you and I'll help your career and you can come in and work out with me until you get another player.
No.
I think this is, hey, Raonic is ranked higher than me now. Why are you working with him? Like,
I think it was almost more a cry for help, you know? Rather than why are you working for him, it's more like,
I think
we need this.
Good energy to have in the camp. You know, Moya clubs the forehand.
Sure, which is not something we've always been able to say about Nadal. I mean, obviously,
yeah.
It's huge. It's a big forehand, obviously, but I mean, I think Moya's pace was kind of at a different level than what Nadal obviously hits typically.
Ironically, if you watch Rafa warm up, if anyone's like, yeah, I mean, you start talking about Rafa's forehand, and it's really easy to upset a lot of people, right?
Sure.
But before you make any really big judgments about Rafa's forehand, you have to watch the guy warm up and try and watch it in person. He will hit forehands 100 miles an hour just warming up.
Right. Well, I mean, we know he's capable of it. I mean, when we look back at 2010, when he did win the US Open, I mean, the two things that stood out were that he started hitting the serve 130 and really attacking the first serve. And then, you know, he flattened out the forehand. You know, the buggy whip finish kind of disappeared. The finish was a little more Federer-like across, you know, across the shoulder. And he flattened that out thing and was more aggressive with it. And we saw that, you know, the results that had. And then obviously the next year he turns around and returns to what he knew best. But, I mean, that he has the capacity to hit 100 mile an hour forehands is not something I think that we've ever doubted. It's more a question of why he hasn't done more of that in matches.
Yeah. Well, I think Moya's going to push him and tell him, look, like, I know how good your forehand is because, you know, Moya knows. Moya knows
sure.
what he can do. And an extra voice that's even, let's assume that Uncle Tony's telling him to hit it bigger. I think an extra voice that's a player, because keep in mind, Uncle Tony comes from a different place.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a better chance that Rafa's going to listen to that. And it wouldn't always be the case, but the fact that in a very public way he's brought Moya on and brought him away from a player that Moya probably could have stayed with for a number of years and had a very nice little career, mm-hmm. you know, as a coach.
Sure.
I think that tells us, like, he's really dedicated to something, committed to something. And,
right.
and a dedicated Rafa, I mean, that's so far been a very impressive and dangerous thing.
Sure. But, I mean, I think that we're at the point now in Nadal's career where he has to flatten out the forehand. He has to start going after the serve more. You know, I don't see a way that he can come back out on the tour and play the way that he's traditionally played and get back inside the top five, get back inside the top three, win more slams. I mean, I will say, not to toot my own horn, but I've had a tradition of making some pretty bold but correct picks with Nadal. I don't mm-hmm. know if you remember back in 2009 when he was on his long streak at Roland Garros. Before the tournament, early in the year, I said that I didn't think he would even reach the finals. And obviously that was the year that he fell out.
You're pulling that one up because you did make an unbelievable pick.
Right, but I will say this. I started saying at the end of 2014 that I think Nadal will win maybe one more slam, maybe at Roland Garros, and outside of that I don't think he'll win another one, and maybe not even that. And I still feel like that's true. And here we are 2 years later, and Nadal's, you know, slamless, and I don't know that I see that changing.
So I think it's important why you're making the pick, right? Like in 2009, I think that's an injury issue. I think if he's healthy, he wins. Now, obviously,
I don't know. Sutherland came out pretty hot, and I don't know. I don't know about that one, but continue.
There was a stretch there where Rafa basically only lost matches when he was injured.
On clay, or just period?
I mean, period. For like 2 years, he lost a few, obviously. But, yeah, I mean, it was like in slams and in the big events, he was only losing when he'd basically played himself an injury.
Okay.
Which is impressive. But I think that Rafa can get back to it if he's healthy, and that's, you know, I really don't think that the game, I think his game will come. I think the guy hasn't had, you know, an actual healthy season in years.
Right, but I mean I don't know
if
that that's ever going to change.
He's never going to get right. I mean, if you just want to say that he's not ever going to be healthy, that he's just working with basically half a deck of cards, then, you know, I mean, that's a tough one.
Yeah, but I think it's a little more than that, too. I mean, at this point, you know, it's a little bit like what we saw with Federer. I mean, some of the mystique has gone away, some of the fear factor. You know, I mean, like, there was that period where it was, you know, Darth Federer. Nobody wanted to play the man. Nobody wanted to play the man, you know? There was that yeah. aura about him. He walked out in the court, and it was just more about the show, the spectacle of watching him come up with that magic. And, you know, with Nadal, it was a different... I mean, certainly there was a similar fear factor, but it came from a little bit of a different place, you know. It was more of a, like, dear God, this bull's about to trample me.
Well, you've written about this. I know that
sure.
you wrote about this years ago. Federer, at some point in his career, changed the way he was playing tennis. He changed the patterns. He didn't use the same shots. At some point, he changed rackets, even. I mean... the mystique went away, in my opinion, because the tennis changed.
Sure.
And after the level drops, you know what? I mean, these guys are pretty good. Like, a couple of months after it drops, everybody starts to smell blood.
Right. No, and absolutely. And I think the blood's been in the water with Nadal for a couple of years now, obviously, and we've seen that. I mean, I think the difference is that people don't have the same feel. Like, I think the physicality of Nadal's game used to be so intimidating. You knew. If you walked, didn't matter what the surface was, you're walking out to play Nadal, and it was going to be just an ugly, ugly, ugly thing. You're going to be out there running till you want to puke. You know, you're going to leave that court just feeling like you got mugged in a back alley somewhere. And I think a little bit of that sense is gone, you know?
Do you think that he runs people as much as he used to?
Well, obviously we didn't see him play as much as that remains to be seen. But I think the point is that he can't afford to. I think he has to come out and he has to use the serve as more of a weapon. He has to use the forehand to finish points early and not try to just grind people down, but instead a little more hit them off the court. And look, I think his backhand is very, very underrated. I think that his backhand is a lot better than people have ever given it credit for. And I think he can use that and not have to run around the forehand run around the backhand so much to hit the forehand. I mean, I think he can just step in and really drive some backhands and do some damage on that wing too. If he doesn't, then I don't think he wins another slam. And I think even if he does, I think he's got maybe one more in him. I just don't think his body can handle it, and I don't think that the fear factor is as strong as it once was. And those two things combined, people know they can come out and come out swinging and have a good shot of taking him down.
So if Rafa plays Novak this year at Roland Garros, who comes out ahead?
I think if all things being equal, I think Novak comes out ahead, but you know, it remains to see. We've got to see how Novak's going to bounce back from 2016. I mean, obviously, a good year for him, but not a great year. And again, we've seen kind of some of the mystique start to wear off a little bit, and we've seen a resurgent Murray. But I mean, I think Djokovic takes that in all probability. But obviously, there's no guarantees. But
I still just, if I'm, when we're at Roland Garros, you know, 6 months from now or whatever it is, I don't want to see Rafa's name come up. I'd still rather play anybody there but him.
Well, sure. I mean, of course, you never want to play Nadal at Roland Garros. I mean, you'd have to be a crazy person. But, you know, we'll see. I think, interestingly, though, if we start to look at, obviously, Nadal is coming to the tail end of his career. Djokovic has started to show a few cracks. You know, Federer, who knows what's going to happen there. But when we start to think about who's going to fill in these voids that are inevitably going to come, I mean, Federer may still be, you know, competing for Grand Slam titles when he's 50, who knows. Mm-hmm. But, you know, very interestingly, we've got Nick Kyrgios, who I think a lot of people are very, very intrigued by. I mean, he's an enigmatic player, professes his dislike for the sport, and yet continues to play at the professional level despite having enough money to stop. But Nadal made some interesting comments very, very recently. He said, and I'll just quote him directly here, "Nick Kyrgios is already at the top," and forgive me, I can't do a good Spanish accent. "He is a player who has an unbelievable potential. He has focus on himself and can become world number one and win a Grand Slam." What do you think?
I mean, we're talking about what are we going to see from Raonic next year? What are we going to see from Rafa next year? And one of the big questions is, are some of these young guys just going to pass him by?
Sure.
I mean, Nick's 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the French guy, Lucas Pouillet, I don't know how to pronounce that. That one's a tough one for me. I think he's 22.
Right, Zverev. I mean, there's a hope we have a cohort of these young guns coming through.
Yeah, well, I mean, these guys, I mean, 21 and 22 years old, and you're in the top 15 in the world. And, you know, I mean, TM obviously is in the top 10 and made it to the Tour Finals this year. He's a couple of years older than Kyrgios, I think, at 23.
Which is crazy, because you've got to think, it was just a year or two ago that we were looking at a top 100 that it barely had anybody under the age of 21. I'm like, was there even one person under the age of 21 in the top 100 a year ago, 2 years ago? I'm not sure there was. Maybe one.
A year ago, there was Hyung Chung, who made it to 53 from Korea as a teenager. But then, of course, I mean, injured right away. He had massive injuries that he still was on and off with for the last, like, 6 or 8 months.
I guess point being, we've just seen this
before,
long...
I don't think we've had anybody.
We've seen this trend over, you know, like, the last decade, essentially, of the average age of the top 100 just climbing up and up and up, and especially the average age in the top 10, I think, is higher than it's ever been. And now all of a sudden we see, you know, this wave of young players coming up. And like I said, Kyrgios really has captured a lot of people's imagination. He certainly polarizes people with the way that he goes about things, and his history of tanking some matches and getting fined, and the way he handles
he's
press conferences.
He's only tanked a few matches.
Right, but when he's tanked them, I mean, look, I think there's been a lot of professional players that have tanked matches. The difference is when Kyrgios has tanked a match, he's done it in spectacular fashion, not even pretending to care about the outcome.
He's, in a sense, when Nick plays, you could say he wears his heart on his sleeve, or you could just say that he's genuine.
Sure. I mean, you know, there's that old saying that if something's worth doing, it's worth doing well. And when it comes to tanking, I mean, Kyrgios really, really has raised the bar. We've never seen anything quite like it.
When he doesn't want to be there, he really doesn't want to be there, and he's not faking it.
Sure.
And you know, there's a certain amount where, you know, Nick's a nice guy, okay? Like, he's not one of the guys around the tour where people just think, like, that guy's a jerk.
Right.
Like, he's a nice guy. People like him. Sure, everyone thinks that he says some stupid stuff, but most of the guys say some stupid stuff. They just don't say it as loudly as Nick does.
Right.
You know, and when he doesn't want to play, he just says, hey, I don't want to play, and he makes it obvious, and everybody knows. And then usually, I mean, from what I can tell, he apologizes to the fans. He says pretty much, doesn't feel like it's in my control. I don't know what to tell you.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's a maturity issue there. And this is one of the things I think is really interesting about Kyrgios. When we compare him to Raonic, who Raonic is, I think, at the other end of the spectrum, where he's so controlled and so in control, I think, of his career. When you look at Kyrgios, he has gone from being, you know, playing ITF junior events, and he gets his first ATP point, and then 2 years later he's in the top 15, has stayed there ever since. He's had this, what in modern terms is this meteoric rise. Okay, and he hasn't really had what I would consider to be stabilization periods. When we look at Raonic, it took him 4 years to do what Kyrgios has done in two. And every time when you look at Raonic's rankings and watch and track the way that it's happened. So, I mean, so he gets his first ATP points back in 2007, right? He hangs around at like 1,300 in the world for a year. This is 6'5" Raonic with this massive, hangs around at 1,300 in the world, you know, like bouncing between 1,500 and 1,300 for a full year, leaps up just inside the top 900 in the world, hangs around there for another 6 months, actually a little bit longer than that, 9 months, then takes another leap. So we see he makes these massive climbs, and then he stabilizes for 6 months to a year, and then makes another climb and stabilizes. And at every point in the way, you know, he's had this period where he's kind of locked things down, and I think that's been really healthy for him, and it's helped him to mature and learn how to handle each stage of the tour in an appropriate fashion, where Kyrgios has just been thrust straight into the limelight. He's from this country that has this long history of not just great athletes but great tennis players, particularly. I mean,
sport is so big in Australia.
Right. I mean, you look at the lineage there, and you know, obviously, I would know being from Australia myself. But I mean, we just have this history of producing tennis champions, and obviously, it's been a little while for us, you know, since Hewitt.
and you know, you told me for years about how important sport was to the culture there.
Yeah,
and I mean,
it's part of our national identity.
Yeah, I mean, as an American, I felt like, yeah, you know, sport's huge over here, too. We have the NFL and the NBA.
It's
and
different.
We have, like, the most tennis tournaments.
It's just different.
It is not the same.
It's just different. Yeah.
If you haven't been to Australia in the summer, which is, you know, like November, December, January in the time of year, I mean, tennis is everywhere. It's the equivalent of having, like, American Idol is like the local tennis tournament in Brisbane or Sydney leading up to the Australian Open.
Right.
I mean, it's huge.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Absolutely. So, I mean, that puts a lot of pressure on a young kid like Kyrgios, and he hasn't really had that period of, what, you know, like I mentioned, stabilization, where he's gotten to get used to a moderate amount of attention and then progresses in the sport, gets used to a higher level of attention, then progresses in the sport. He's just gone from 0 to 100. And I think he's paying the price for that. I mean, he's a kid. And, you know, it's funny because I think not that long ago I really was feeling quite almost embarrassed by the way he's behaved. Especially, you know, before Hewitt, you look at all the Australian champions that we had, and we really had that history of, I don't know if I could quite use the word dignified, just because obviously we had a lot of the Australian champions who would go out drinking the night before the Wimbledon final. But here's the difference is they would go out drinking together and then show up and play each other in the final the next day. There was that sportsmanship, that kind of, I don't know, integrity the way they did things, and that spirit, that really good-heartedness. And Hewitt was the first time we kind of had an Australian tennis champion that was not like that. And I'll tell you, you know, he wasn't as popular when he first came on the scene, just because of the way that he behaved, and it was very different from what we'd seen before. And, you know, I not that long ago, I was really kind of embarrassed by the way Kyrgios was handling himself. You know, it was like, God, this guy's Australian. But I will say, I took a moment and really stepped outside of that and realized he's just a kid. And, you know, if I look around at, you know, obviously having worked in college athletics for quite some time now, I see people that are the same age as Nick Kyrgios, who are on scholarship for different sports in college, behaving in a similar fashion. And the difference is they don't have millions of dollars, they don't have the world spotlight on them, and they're still struggling to find themselves and get this sense of identity. And this kid's got to do this in front of the whole world, you know, and every move he makes gets criticized. That's just not an easy place to be. So I will say, like, I think everybody's got to kind of take a deep breath and cut him some slack, and, you know, we'll hopefully take a little bit of that pressure off and give him some room to figure out the kind of man that he wants to be and see what that looks like.
It's a good point, because we've both seen other players, seen other guys and girls that have frankly behaved worse than anything that Nick has done.
Sure.
A lot worse.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I've seen it with my own two eyes.
Yeah. And so, you know, every person on that continent, you know, virtually, has a part of their attention turned towards Kyrgios.
I mean, not just that continent, though. I mean, let's be real. He's, like I said, he's very polarizing, but he's extremely popular all over the world.
Well, I mean, so let's compare him to Raonic for a second, okay?
Right.
Because Milos is number 3 in the rankings right now. He's 25 years old. Kyrgios is 21. Milos has an absolute cannon of a serve.
Yeah, Kyrgios' serve's pretty stinking good, too.
I'm going to say Kyrgios' serve is significantly better than Raonic.
That's a big statement.
That's not a small statement.
That's a big, big statement.
Now, Raonic has a big forehand to back up this cannon of a serve, right?
Right.
I'm going to say Kyrgios' forehand is so much better than Milos's. I don't even know how to make the comparison.
Okay, well, let's pause there in a second, because the next thing I was about to say is that when we look at the statistics, I mean, Kyrgios is already pegging himself as one of the better servers in the sport, and I think has the potential to be one of the greatest when it comes to the serving side of things. Now, I looked at some statistics, because this is just what I do, and, you know, his numbers on the serve don't match up to Raonic's, you know, realistically. So he's winning 76% of his first serve, which puts him at 13th on the tour. Raonic is winning 80%. Second serves won, they're virtually identical. You know, Kyrgios is at 55.1, Raonic is at 55.3. But then when we look at service games won as well, we've got Kyrgios at 88.7%, Raonic at 90.6. Now, I know that's not a huge difference. We're talking about 2%. But, I mean, 2%...
It's the difference between being number 13 and being number 3.
Well, exactly, you know. And when we talk about how much better Kyrgios' forehand is, and also I think that Kyrgios is a better mover than Raonic, you know, I got a question you saying that Kyrgios is a better server than Raonic. I don't know that holds true.
I didn't say that he was a better server. I said he has
a better serve. Okay.
What Kyrgios can do with the ball, I don't know that we have ever seen anyone on the tour be able to do.
Yeah, on the serve, you mean? Specifically?
On the serve.
Yeah, okay.
The guy's a 6'5", more explosive version of Pete Sampras.
Right.
Now, the caveat to that...
And we all know how much Pete's serve sucked.
Yeah, I mean... You know, you wouldn't want to compare yourself to him. The thing that I want to keep in mind is Nick has some technical issues on the serve, which, you know, podcast number one, bold prediction of the day, you go against Rafa ever winning another slam, Nick's going to have some pretty serious injuries at some point. He's probably already starting to feel it.
Okay.
So one of the things that I don't talk about a lot, but I almost give him a pass, there are times when he doesn't want to play a tournament. I think he shouldn't even play the tournament.
Right.
Because the guy's like, I think you have to treat him the same way you would treat a pitcher in Major League Baseball that's throwing down serious heat, and he's got to be on a pitch count.
Right. Because sure. And then they pull him, and he doesn't pitch again for 5 days or 6 days or a week.
He's only got a certain number of serves in that shoulder because of the way he goes about hitting it, and he could tweak his technique and change it, and he could play forever. And then, like if he was to fix his service technique, then I would say it's just a matter of time before he's number one.
Right. Well, he's a big boy. You know, I mean, he's got a lot of muscle mass to him. And actually, this is one of the interesting things too. Is when we look at what is traditionally the single biggest predictor of success in junior tennis, it's agility, right? And I remember not that long ago, you actually unearthed this video and sent it to me of Kyrgios playing a tournament as a 14-year-old. And, I mean, yeah. It's kind of, I think maybe the biggest comparison I could make is, what's his face from Jurassic World? That was Andy Dwyer on Parks and Rec. I'm killing you here, aren't I?
You're reaching into a land of pop culture that.
Okay. Well, anyway, I guess the short of it is that at 14, Kyrgios was a lot rounder than he is today.
Well, okay. Let's just be for the sake of anyone who's unfortunately listening to this. Let's just say that he was a fat kid.
Right. Now, and I'm not trying to body shame a 14-year-old here, but I mean, it's relevant. I mean, for him to have had the success that he had as a junior.
Compared to all the other tennis players.
Right.
He was a fat kid.
Yeah, he was definitely a bigger boy than the average tennis player that age.
He was huge. No. But he was probably carrying an extra, 10 or 15% body fat.
Right.
And all of his other
contemporaries,
peers, like everyone else that's ITF top 500, I mean, these guys are they have nobody.
Right. I mean, you know, when we saw a similar video of Rionic playing Del Potro, I mean, it's a very, very different thing. So the fact that he was able to have that kind of success as a junior despite not being particularly agile was, I think, very impressive. And then as we've seen him mature into the athlete that he is today, I mean, he has the potential physically. Reminds me a lot of Safin, just like a physical beast. And, if he can clean up that technique, then, some interesting things are going to happen. But I think, obviously, unless he can sort out the mental and emotional side of things, we're going to continue to see a similar kind of pattern in his play. The consistency is not going to be there.
Let's give Nick credit, first of all, because coming from where he came from, I mean, if you go and Google some stuff and even just find a picture of him when he's 14, 15, 16 years old, you can tell, okay, this guy was not born like a Michael Jordan, okay?
Right.
He just wasn't. So people now want to give him a hard time and call him lazy and say lots of stuff about him because they see little bits and pieces of his behavior.
Right, but he's done the work, obviously.
Yeah.
He's done some hard work.
You don't get to be where he is without working hard.
Right.
And you sure as heck don't get there from where he came from.
Right.
Without working really hard. So he might have been one of the hardest working kids in Australia for long stretches of time. And that's saying something because that country has some really hard working kids.
Right.
But right now, fast forward to 2017, I mean, Nick doesn't have a coach. He's not going to change his technique.
Right.
Like, he's not at home, calling up Craig O'Shaughnessy, getting, extra video and sitting in Dartfish and figuring out what's going on with the, how can he get 1% better on his serve and 5% better on his backhand.
Right.
That's
not happening.
Not happening. And so he's not going to change his technique except for how it's just going to sort of organically flow as he continues to mature over the next several years.
Right, but if he does have these underlying injuries and he doesn't get the serve fixed properly, what we may actually see is a de-evolution of his technique as he starts shielding himself and kind of guarding against the pain.
Yeah, a little bit. I think, I'll tell you, my expectation would be he would be a little bit like Stan Wawrinka, where he's just going to kind of save his best stuff for the big tournaments.
Right.
I think you'll see him have some early exits.
Well, we're seeing that already anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you think of it as a strategy instead of as an attitude problem, it's not a bad strategy.
Sure.
If you think it's an attitude problem, then it's a terrible problem. But the real question with Nick is going to be, you know, what's the attitude? What's the commitment level? Does he want to continue to get in better and better shape? I mean, the guy actually moves very, he moves extraordinarily well.
For his size, yeah.
Yeah, he's, what, 6'5"?
Yeah, like, I mean, you mentioned earlier Raonic moves well for his size, but I mean, I think Kyrgios makes Raonic look slow.
Oh, I mean, massively.
Yeah.
Kyrgios can run down just about any drop shot.
Yeah, so it reminds you a little bit of Monfi, and just that, like, that athleticism with that height is just something you don't see very often. Except I think Kyrgios carries a bigger muscle mass on him, you know, he's just kind of a bigger frame. So what does 2017 look like for Kyrgios then? I mean, I think this is probably the hardest one to predict of all because he's a bit of a wild card.
I mean, if you pull up the rankings, right, he's finished the year at 13th.
Right.
Okay. But the distance between where he is and, say, where Cilic is, who's number 6.
It's massive.
Is one tournament. The distance is not that big.
Right.
So, to me, I mean, if Kyrgios isn't in London at the end of 2017, I would either he's hurt and he's just sidelined, or I'm shocked.
Do you think that he can emotionally carry that level of play through the year? Because,
yeah.
I mean, I personally feel like the gap between, for Kyrgios, the gap between 13 and 6 is big. I mean, you talk about being one tournament, but I mean, I think it's much bigger than that in a sense of, you know, the extra pressure that comes along with that, the extra tension that comes along with that. I mean, I think we're more likely to see kind of some sort of a reaction from Kyrgios that sees him drop out of the top 20 than we are to see him climb into the top 5.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I mean, I'm hoping not. Don't get me wrong. Like,
I don't think that he's done the work to show up and win Wimbledon or to show up and win the Australian Open, his home slam. Like, I don't see him winning in Melbourne, but if he doesn't make his seed and make the round of 16, I mean, it would be really surprising.
Well, but all it takes now is him to show up and have one of those days where he just walks from side to side and, you know, he's going to the bench while his opponent's still tossing the ball for serving, you know?
I just don't see him doing that in Melbourne.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I can't... Well, you know, who knows? I think that's a big question.
I think
it's unlikely.
Likely, but what could happen is if he gets the wrong draw, like, he could draw Steve Johnson in the first round.
Right.
Or
dangerous
or
floater there.
Or something in the first round.
Right.
Or Delpo. Who's not going to be seeded in Australia. You know, if you draw Delpo in round 1 or 2, I mean, you might just lose.
Sure.
You know.
Well, yeah.
But at the same
good
time,
chance of
like,
that. Yeah.
Nick is one of the few guys where I think Nick could just play Delpo off the court.
Could.
I mean.
He could.
He's capable of it.
For sure.
So.
I think the reverse is also true, though, if we're going to be honest about it. I mean, when Delpo starts cracking that forehand.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you give Delpo time, he can hit anybody off the court. I think when you look at Nick and what he's going to do in 2017, it's really easy. I can see a lot of ways where he could do quarters or semis and slams. I can even see a lot of ways where he can do finals and then, say, succumb to the pressure of not winning the slam final. But to fall out of the top 20, I mean, he would have to be hurt, for him to be out of the top 20.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're probably not wrong about that. I just am really curious to see what happens this year as the pressure starts to build. You know, we've seen him act out a lot. Does he mature? Does he take this time over, you know, the incredibly short off season that tennis players get? And you know, does he kind of come out of a little bit of a wiser man, or does he, you know, come back and explode? Who knows? I guess for sure
he comes back wiser, but he's still going
to
act out.
Well, sure. To what degree is really the big question, but I guess we'll have to stay tuned and figure that out. Well, we're going to wrap up there. Thank you to everybody who listened, and you know, we'll
it's gonna be fun.
Yeah, it's gonna be fun. This is gonna be a regular feature on Tactical Tennis. We're gonna try to get out, I would say, probably between 30 and 40 of these a year. And hopefully have some interesting discussion. Feel free to shoot in some comments or ideas or things you would like to see discussed in future podcasts. You can reach me at glenn@tactical.tennis, and Jacob, you're at jacob@tactical.tennis.
Nice and easy.
Yeah, we'll look forward to hearing from you guys and girls. Have a great one, and next time you hear Jacob, he'll be down under in Australia at the Australian Open. And
podcasting live from Melbourne.
Right, and I will still be right here in Atlanta. So,
love it,
all right, have a good one. Merry Christmas, everybody. Have a great holiday. Stay safe, and we'll see you all in 2017.